There's a phrase that's been very present for me recently that I read in Stephen Batchelor's latest book, After Buddhism. Actually, it's two phrases, but it's only eight words. And it's supposedly the last words that the person we call the Buddha said to some of his disciples who were gathered around when he was dying. And in Stephen's translation, I'm assuming this was in Pali that it was recorded, several hundred years after the Buddha died, but Stephen's translation is, things fall apart, period, tread the path with care. Traduction?
Oui, pour la deuxième partie. Là.
Oui. Je sais pas.
Marcher sur le chemin avec attention. Marcher sur le chemin avec attention. Collatéral.
Oui. Oui. So, I've been thinking a lot about this, and in the interview that Joa and I did with Stephen, the subject of the interview was for this magazine, is the theme of the magazine is cheminée, so walking the path or something like that in English. And so the theme of the interview was that, having Stephen talk about his path and how he sees the path and all of this. So naturally, because this was already in my mind, this phrase, and it came up, and I asked him, so this is what you said in the book, so what does this mean? What's the path? That's my first question, the path. And his answer was fine. He said basically that for him, the interpretation was the path is the Eightfold Path, which is part of the Buddha's original teachings. And then he gave us a lengthy discussion about care, about what care means, which Stephen, in his view, is the key word in Dharma practice, care. So, this was not, as we would say in French, ça n'a pas épuisé le sujet for me. Did not exhaust the question for me. Not so much things fall apart, but so what does it mean, tread the path with care? What does it mean, what's the path? And what is care? And I realized that it is really what the whole practice is about, in fact. So it's interesting that that should be the Buddha's final words, because that's really what it's about. And what our practice is. So let's see, how have I been approaching this? Because I'm not the kind of articulate scholar that Stephen is, my first thought would be not that the path is the Eightfold Path. Of course, I completely agree with him on that point, but that's not how I would... The Eightfold Path? C'est ça.
L'ensemble de la phrase, il a dit quelque chose et toi tu vois ça de la même façon.
Oui, puisque moi je ne suis pas. Je n'ai pas je n'ai pas fait l'étude et je n'ai pas l'intelligence et l'articulation de Stephen. Je ne dirais pas que le chemin c'est le sentier. Le sentier c'est le sentier octuple. Bien que je suis d'accord avec ça, mais ce ne sera pas ma façon de l'exprimer. And oh, I think not only not my personal expression of it, but I think in Zen we would not immediately say that either. You're probably all sitting here thinking, well, what is the Eightfold Path? You know, so because we don't talk about it. It's not really part of our curriculum. It's part of our approach. In fact, I can't think of any Zen teaching that discusses the Eightfold Path, just off the top of my head. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, the teaching, and that it's not valid. It's just that that's not the approach that we use. So, the path probably for me is more like the path is your life. Ici, maintenant, right now, this is the path. Every moment is the path. So wherever it takes you, that's the path. So wherever you are, that's the path. Which would be more the Zen interpretation. So but so what does that mean then, to tread it with care? Things fall apart, I think we can all understand, right? Because we all have that experience. We get old, we get sick, we lose things, people die, we change jobs, we change homes, chairs break, things don't happen like we want them to happen. Night becomes day and day becomes night. Summer becomes fall. Flowers bloom and then they fall away. We know this. Things fall apart. A favorite piece of clothing, you get holes in the knees. The car breaks down, things fall apart. So, what then? What do we do then? What do you do? Things fall apart, so how do you live with things falling apart? And he very kindly says to his disciples, so things fall apart. Tread the path with care. It doesn't only mean be careful. Be careful, you might break it. Be careful, take care of it so that it doesn't fall apart. It doesn't only mean that. There's a notion of appreciation in it. So appreciate what it is now, what is here now, so that you won't regret when it has fallen apart, because you fully experienced it now. So, you know, I say to people with small children, because I know, we know what happens to the children, right? They are no longer tiny little babies that are 14 months old. They become big 21-year-old boy men who don't do what you want them to do. Or you have to let them do their thing, even if you see them making mistakes. Or not. We know this is what happens. very clear as a parent. But we also see that as not a parent. We all grew up. We have all grown up, and we're not 16 anymore. Maybe that was, you know, the greatest moment of our life, but we're not. Or 20, or 25, even 30. I think everyone here is over 30. And people die, you know, whatever. Things fall apart, we know that. So appreciate it while it's here. You know, it's the famous carpe diem, seize the day, right? Do it now because you won't have another chance. Or don't do it now because you don't want to harm what is now. So don't do something because you want this to be as it is now. And you could ruin it if you do something else. These are all hypothetical, but I think we can find concrete situations to apply to all of these. So there's that aspect of appreciation. There's also the aspect of well, I guess what we would popularly call mindfulness, so attentiveness. So be attentive to what is here now. Be attentive to this. It's like if you are, you know, Zen practice is kind of like climbing a mountain, maybe. You might start out in Zen practice like, oh, I want the meaning of life, or I want peace, or some thing started out with. But as you go along, it's like with the mountain, you know, it's this beautiful thing, and it's this enormous challenge, and fresh air, and beautiful scenery. But as you're going along, you have to be attentive to every step if you're climbing a mountain. Peter Matheson's book is wonderful for that. I forget which one it is. Nine-headed dragon river or snow leopard, but there's a situation when he's on this really narrow path in the Himalayas, and he's got his huge backpack, and I think he's got blisters, his boots.
Snow leopard, yeah.
And so he's got blisters, and he made the mistake of buying new boots or something, I don't remember what it was. And he's, you know, on one side he's got this wall, the cliff. And on the other side, he's got this wall, the cliff. So one is going up and one is going down. And it's like, you know, the thing between a rock and a hard place. So he can't go any farther here. And he can't go any farther there. And if he's paying too much attention to one or the other, he's going to get hurt. He's going to, you know, if he's paying too much attention to this, he's going to fall. Or to this, he's going to fall. So at the same time, what you realize is it's just one step at a time. And if you just focus on that, you're okay. And it's endless steps. It's endless. And the same thing is with Zen practices. It's just, first you start out with this big elation and this blissful thing, or maybe not, but there's all these aspirations, whatever. And then it's just practice after practice after practice. And training after training after training. And sitting after sitting after sitting. So treading the path with care is to appreciate that. It's to, okay, sometimes it's just practice after practice after practice. You think, what am I doing here? Why did I come? Why am I wasting my time this weekend? It's so beautiful out there. I could have been staying at home and doing this, or seeing this person, or really, why do this? You know, what's the point of this? Well, there are those moments, you know, like with your boots that are giving you blisters and the pack that's so heavy, and you're thinking, I could have just stayed at home, why am I here in the Himalayas, you know? Altitude sickness and frostbite and blisters and terror of falling off the cliff, and anything could happen, you know. But if we can get through those moments, it's just this step. That's what treading the path with care is. Just this step. Not moving ahead to the next step. Not looking back to the back previous step. Not looking right or left. Or what this guy's doing or what she's doing, and she's so far ahead of me, or I'm so much better than him. None of that. Just this step. My step right here, where I am. That's what treading the path with care is too. And then another aspect of care, which actually, you know, I'm going through all of these steps, and you could probably find a parallel with the Eightfold Path if you looked at it. But I'm not a scholar in the Eightfold Path, so I'm not going to try to find comparisons. But you probably could. Another aspect of this care is that it does involve the person on my right and my left, and the person ahead and the person behind. And it does involve the cliff here and this here. It involves it all. It includes it all. And we have to include it all. That's part of treading the path with care. It's to see that, I mean, part of what we learn in this treading the path in the Zen way is that who we are true, who we truly are, our true self, is not what we think. It's not who we think we are. And it's actually the true self is the interconnectedness, the interconnection of all of it. I was talking to Christine last night about the trees, and I don't know if it was someone in a Dharma talk who mentioned this, or if I read it somewhere, I don't know. But there's this book by a German scientist who talks about how the life of trees and how they are incredibly compassionate and aware of the interconnection between them all, and so they help each other. Like there's this whole ecosystem underground, and that they help each other. If one doesn't have enough water, the others may take less so that the one that doesn't have enough can get it, or various things. I can't remember all the details, but it's absolutely stunning, the studies that this guy's done. And there's an intelligence of interdependence in trees that puts us to shame, in a sense. We have that possibility. We have that potential. But we are so occupied with thought, what we think, and what we think, who we think we are, and who we think the others are, and what we're thinking about doing or not doing, that we lose touch with that interdependence and that interconnection. But that's who we really are. That's who really myself is. So when we say, you know, my Dharma name, Tu es cela, that's not a concept. That's who we are. Well, I guess another way of saying it would be that, so who we really are is not a product of thought. So we're thinking, when we're identifying with ourself, we're identifying with a product of thought, something that we've produced through thought. And that's not who we really are. That's just a product of thought. It's just an idea or a fantasy, say, a construction of our thoughts, say. And so in our Zen practice, that's the importance of our sitting, is to go beyond thought. It's not eliminating thought, but because thought is coming and going all the time while we're sitting here. But it's to go, I say beyond because it's, you have to find terminology for it, but it's to not enter into that coming and going and not attach to it or to reject it. So it sounds like this is a vast pogana, but it's not really. Because it's usually what we do is we enter into it. In fact, we're already in the middle of it. When we sit down, we're already in the middle of this coming and going thought. But if we can sit through this practice after practice after practice, sitting after sitting after sitting, at some point, we are no longer entering into that thought process, that coming and going. Which means that we're not grabbing onto it or rejecting it. Because when we're in the middle of it, we're caught in the, I want this and I don't want that. And so it's like there's no way out. We're trapped. We don't experience it that way exactly, but we do, too. We just feel like so closed in by all this stuff. And tiraillé in different directions. I want this, I want that, I don't want this, I don't want that. Whatever. That's the importance of the sitting. So if we have to find a reason why we do it, that's it. It's that, so that we can go beyond this coming and going of the thoughts. And because that's where the liberation is. When we are no longer determined by our thoughts, both our actions and our reactions. So how we react to things or how we act on things are not determined by thought anymore. And that's where we're free. And that's what it is to tread the path with care. Because then we can be aware. We're only aware of half of, even half, when we're caught in our thoughts. Because we're so occupied by our thoughts and how we think things are and who we think we are that we don't even see a big part of things as they are. So we can't possibly tread the path with care if we don't see the path. If we don't see treading, if we don't see our footsteps, if we don't see this footstep right here. But this does not mean, is often we think, okay, if I'm not thinking, then I'm just dumb. It's not about not thinking. Maybe, you know, there's the Zen thing of, I forget which master it was, who said, think not thinking. It was probably even Dogen, but think not thinking. But that's not a thought. It's just a way of our usual use of language cannot say it. So we have to use these convoluted type things. Think not thinking. But it involves, okay, first looking at what is thinking. So becoming aware of the thought, the coming and going of thoughts. Right. And we're familiar with that from sitting here on the cushion. I hope that we're familiar with that. I'm making this assumption that after all this time sitting, you're aware of the coming and going of thoughts. And, you know, at some moments, the illusion of what those thoughts are, that they're like clouds. I'm hoping, you know, they have as much substance as a cloud. Even less, maybe, substance than a cloud. And if you don't, then I would encourage you to sit and look at that. Say, okay, well, wait, what's she talking about? what's this coming and going of thoughts, and what is a thought, and even go beyond to Mark Epstein's famous phrase, thoughts without a thinker. So who's having the thoughts? That's another step, but first we have to see the thoughts, the coming and going of the thoughts, and then see the nature of the thoughts, and then maybe move on to the nature of the thinker. If you see the coming and going of the thoughts, you have a good chance of seeing what the nature of the thoughts are. And if you see the nature of the thoughts, then you have a good chance of seeing what the nature of the thinker is. And all of that is part of treading the path with care. It's difficult to appreciate the path and the treading and all that that entails if we are thinking it, if it's a concept, and if we are thinking about ourselves all the time. It's hard to open to the caring of the interdependence if we don't see that interdependence, and if we're stuck in our thoughts, caught in our thoughts, we won't see that interdependence, because it can't be thought that. It's impossible to think that. Thought to think separation and difference, differentiation.
I think that we usually don't get as much stuck into concepts. We get stuck into stories, which is maybe the same as what you're saying.
It's maybe an elaboration of a concept, the story. Yeah.
We get stuck in our story, or a story of what Zen is, and what me being a Zen practitioner is, and what this is all about. It's always a big story.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And that's what we grasp more.
Mm.
This is my experience.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a way of explaining to ourselves the concept or something,
yeah.
Maybe. You know. And so we do, yes, and then we get caught in that, and we sit there on our cushion and we're waiting for the bell to ring because, you know, this is like so boring, and we're just practicing and practicing. And then I'm drifting off and thinking about the trees and looking around or moving or maybe not, you know, maybe not looking around and moving, but in my head doing all kinds of stuff, you know, thinking about what I should have said to that woman, or what I should do tomorrow, or what are we going to have for lunch, or even, you know, even stuff that you can't even remember at all. It's so random, you know, or so elaborate that it would be hard to find where the thread is to unravel it, because it's so elaborate and dense what we're sitting here doing, you know. And when we're involved in that, we're not really present with the path and treading it at that moment, because that's not what treading the path is about. So, and then at some point we might remember. It's like with counting, when we count the breath and we lose track, at some point we're like, oh yeah, right. I'm supposed to be counting the breath, and now I hear him thinking about the woman at the market yesterday, and she was smoking a cigarette while she was serving us, and then she put the cigarette down, and I was watching it burning there on the, you know, whatever. Just something, whatever comes to your mind randomly. And you think, oh, wait a minute, I was supposed to be counting. And then you go back to zero. Start again. And it's the same thing. Same thing. We're off thinking about all this stuff and then trying to explain why it's happening and then looking into the psychological aspects of it and what that means and emotionally how I'm feeling about it and all of this stuff. It's not that that's not valid thought. It's not that those are not valid process for well-being. That's not it at all. It's just that what we're doing here is trying to not be caught up in all of that and go beyond it. There's a time and a place for all of that, and there's a time and a place for this. And so when we're here, the time and the place is for this. Right? Of course, no one is going to stand there and read your mind and say, you're not doing it, the time and the place is not for that. Of course not. Because that's not the time, this is not the time and the place for that either. But if we are to tread the path with care, well, we have to do it. Yeah? And ultimately, it comes down to, especially in the Zen way, just do it. Just do it. There's nothing else to, just do it. But that motivation has to come from yourself. You know, people can tell you that. People can tell you, just do it. I can sit here and tell you, just do it. But it doesn't mean anything if it's not coming from yourself. I'm just going to do it. And that's not, it is the slogan for Nike. We know that. Of course, my teacher's teacher maintains that the guy who founded Nike heard him say that in a Dharma talk, just do it, and took the slogan. But for those of you who know my teacher's teacher, you're not surprised to hear that.
Something else coming up that you mentioned, motivation. Sometimes when there is no motivation, when you are caught in this, the only way is to tread with care or appreciate it. And just came up with it. It's when things fall apart. So actually, the things fall apart part of the proper sentence. It's almost like it's the enabling condition, it's the reason for it, but also
absolutely the
drive to do it. It's
absolutely
because things are fall apart.
Absolutely.
That we can appreciate, that we must appreciate.
Yeah. Exactly. If we were immortal and everything was permanent, it would be quite boring. But there would be no motivation to do anything. You know, that's true. Absolutely. And nothing would be appreciated. It's like my son when he was little and he wanted to have birthday parties every day. Or not, he loved his birthday party, so he wanted more of them.
Yeah.
So I would say, so how often do you want to have them? Once a month, and then it'd be it'd be nice if you did every Saturday. So then I would say to him, if you had a birthday party every day, it would be so boring. There would be nothing exciting about it anymore. It would just be what you did every day. And then you would be like, Mom, can't we not have a birthday party today? If everything is always the same, what is there to appreciate? If we could have everything we wanted, which we could not, what else would there be? I think it was Simone de Beauvoir who said something like that. I'm so glad I'm not immortal because there would be nothing to live for if I was, or something. Which is interesting, There would be nothing to live for.
No, I'm just thinking that is typically a thought or a concept, this idea of permanence, because nothing really is ever.
Absolutely.
So, I'm just thinking this is
absolutely
typically something we tend to
think,
hypothetically get caught up into. What if it was another way that it actually is? But
could not be. Yeah. And our experience, if we pay attention to our experience, like you say, is that everything falls apart. If we really, it's like, obviously. Exactly. And so it's interesting that we see that one's really clear. We have this thought of permanence, and our experience tells us it's not true, that things fall apart. But other thoughts we then hang on to like gold, you know, like this is the absolute truth, this thought. And yet, our experience tells us that it's not. But we hang on to the thought. In a reaction to falling apart. You know, we don't want it to fall apart. We want it to be solid. We're terrified of not existing. So we want to think that there is somebody here who exists like we want her to exist, and you know, have these qualities and be solid and be able to count on her and know how she's going to appear to others and know what to do at the right moment and all that stuff. And we actually, we're just creating more trouble for ourselves, because then we no longer know what to do. We're no longer appearing, or we're appearing in a way to the others, but it's off, often. You know, it's not appropriate, as we could say. We're not appreciating the others in the situation and the things as they are. And we make, with our thoughts as well, we make so many distinctions, and so we're preoccupied with differentiating and judging. So we don't see the equality, and we don't see the differences. You know, we want to, you know, so like the refugee issue, we don't see our shared humanity, and we focus only on the differences. And we're overwhelmed by the situation, and so then we focus even more on the differences, because it's so overwhelming, the situation. And on this path, so in Zen practice, by sitting here and seeing the coming and going of thought and going beyond the thought, that coming and going, we learn how to live in this world of differentiation, because that's what our world is. Differentiate. There's different forms, different people, different things you have to do and not do. It's a world of form. The world of form is differentiation. We learn to live in that world, which seems impossible, with equality. So we learn how to live in the world of differentiation with equanimity, let's say, or equality, or seeing the unity or something. Because if you really see that the humanity, if you really see the true nature of yourself, you then will see the true nature of the others, because you'll see that it's one, it's the same. And when you see that, you see the difference too, because you see how amazing. We have the same nature, and yet we're manifesting in a completely different way. It's a manifestation that's completely different than mine, than this one, and yet we have the same nature. And the same thing with the trees and the airplane and the birds and the everything. All these inexhaustible manifestations of one nature. And therefore, then you see the interdependence of it all. the interconnection of it all, because you see we all have the same nature, and none of us would be what we are without the others. There would be no me without you. Maybe, so I said with equality, but maybe it's more like so living in this world of differentiation while avoiding discrimination. So you have to recognize the differences, obviously, but you avoid discriminating and saying this one's better than that one. Because that's where the problems arise. When we start, because we have, it's important to see the differences, otherwise it's totalitarian. And this is where abuse arises, if we don't see the difference. But if we only see difference, then trouble arises as well, because then we exclude and we persecute and we abuse as well. So how can we live with this differentiation while avoiding discrimination? Another vast pogrom, huh? But that's what we learn in our practice. If we can go beyond the thoughts. You know, and that comes back to, so the path, we could also say it's the middle way. The middle way between the two extremes. One would be withdrawing completely from life, denying my feelings, my emotions, focusing only on myself, or the opposite would be indulging in indulging in, you know, pleasures and temptations, and being caught up in all of the worldly world, and not seeing beyond just what I want. So that would be the grasping, and the other one would be the pushing away, the rejecting. Just to boil it down to basic gestures. And so the middle way is what? The middle way is not indulging, but not denying. Not grasping, but not rejecting.
Not holding preferences.
Not holding preferences. Doesn't mean we don't have preferences. The key word is holding. Mm-hmm. So, we can have preferences, but we don't hold on to them. Again, we're not caught in thought. Because preferences, again, you know, it's a thought. And it's okay. There's nothing wrong with the preferences, but what causes the problem is, and it's not that it's even wrong, it's just that the problem is we hold to them. And then we don't see anymore. That's the, so Tiago cites that because that's the line before his Dharma name, or after. So his Dharma name is the perfect way, which is another thing of the middle way, another version of it. And it comes from a poem, and it says the perfect way is not difficult. It just dislikes picking and choosing. So it doesn't hold on to preferences. The perfect way, the middle way, the path, that's why we call it the path of liberation, because that's where we're free. I used to cite this quote from James Joyce, who was talking about, I don't remember what it was, something about appreciating art, I think it was. And he said, yeah, appreciating a work of art. And he said, if you're too far away, you know, you could say a painting even, you know, it could be a movie, it could be a book, it could be anything. If you're too far away from it, if you're too distant, that's the attitude of the critic. That's not good, that's good, this is good. You're removed from it. You're not really involved in it. You're removed. So that's the extreme of, you know, aestheticism, rejecting, pulling away from life. If you're too close, because he's always very provocative, Joyce, he said it's pornographic. If you're too close to it, if you don't have the distance that's appropriate to appreciate it, you know, if you're too in it, you can't appreciate it either, because you're too close. You can't see it really, and that's the equivalent of indulging, grasping, having,
not enough.
Which is not seeing it fully.
So absolutely. Close
that there is an obsession with just one aspect of it. You are so, because you get so close, because
could be,
you are,
yeah,
totally
could
obsessed
be.
Or caught in one energy of it or one aspect, and you don't see the full flower.
You can't, because you're too close. Exactly. Yeah. And so then his point was that he didn't call it the middle way. I forget what he called it, but it's the same thing. The middle way. So you have to find the right, what we call the right, and then we come back to the Eightfold Path, because that is one of the translations, is right speech, right action, right thought, right meditation, right discipline, I forget what they all are,
right livelihood,
right, not as opposed to wrong, but in finding that place that's not too close and not too far away, so it's the right spot for you. And it's not easy to know. How do you know? You know. So we asked Stephen that question too in the interview, because all these questions came up. Remember? Do you remember? No.
Asking.
Well, no. I gave. He was talking. I forget what he was talking about. And maybe it was because, you know, he was leaving. He had left teachers. I forget what it was. Anyway. So I said, you know, often the question comes up with students. Well, how do I know if I'm doing the right thing? You know, how do I know if this is the right life for me? How do I know if this is the right practice? How do I know?
Yeah, what's the right path?
Yeah, right. It was because it was about the path. So how do I know if this is the right path? What is the right path? What is the right? And he, you know, told us a story from his own life of how he had thought of, when he was with some Tibetan teacher, he had thought of going somewhere else, changing practices, and realized that it wasn't the right moment. Realized that if he had done that, he would have been fleeing something, and he hadn't gone far enough into what he was doing, in the practice that he was doing. And so he didn't go. And then he stayed another 5 years, I think, that Tibetan teacher, and then at some point he left after 5 years, but he didn't go to where he had initially thought. He He initially thought of going to Thailand, and he went to Korea instead. But he said at that point, he was mature enough, and he had gone deep enough into the practice that he was doing to realize that he wanted something else. And he realized that initially when he had wanted to go, he wasn't mature enough in his practice to make that decision. And he was smart enough to realize that. So I just say this because how do we know if what we're doing is right, you know? Well, you can only know by your own experience.
What was crucial, I find, what he said was that it was that his path also, it wasn't,
mm-hmm.
he wasn't saying this is the way it should be. He was just could only be a witness and bear witness to what was for him. But he wasn't drawing any conclusions from it also. Right.
That other people should do
what
he did. Although he did say that he firmly believes that people should engage in, you shouldn't hop around. Said, I don't think it's good to hop around. Said, I think you should engage people. It's important to engage in one practice and really do it. Of course, he wasn't saying, like you said, he wasn't saying this is the recipe and this is the rule. But from his experience, that was what he learned, that it was important to engage with something.
Plutôt que de se disperser.
Oui.
Papillonner.
Oui. Hop around, yeah.
On the knowing thing, what we mean by knowing, being certain, being sure. Wouldn't you say, in a certain perspective, and it could also be misleading, but in a certain way, that the body knows, or something only knows?
Mm-hmm. I do think so, yeah.
Not necessarily the art knows. It's more than that, I'd say. The art can be misleading. Would you say?
Yeah, I would say that. Which comes to the heart of what this practice is to become aware of that. Instead of being caught in the head or in the heart. And then, so in Asian languages, you know, like in Chinese and Japanese, they have this good word, which is shin, which is heart-mind. It's not the head and it's not the heart, but it's both. It's heart-mind. It's hard for us to translate that, but it's what you're talking about.
Mm.
And that is where we know. And there's when we feel like we recognize something, or the fact that we're all sitting here, somewhere in that heart-mind, there's something that we know, we recognize in it. And then we get caught up in our head and our thoughts and stuff, and that's what's telling us, oh no, this is not really it, or this is so boring, or whatever. But that's exactly it. Somewhere we know.
I remember many years ago in an interview we had an exchange about something similar to this, on the mind being misleading. And then at that time you told me, because I was, oh, but the heart knows. But you have also to go there and experience yourself that the heart, by itself alone, doesn't know all the time. It can also be misleading. Because it's gut, it's art, it's mind, it's everything. And this knowing with our instrument of being here, the body, I think it's everything combined. Knowing.
Yeah,
like the knowing of a koan.
Yeah, and by sitting here doing this practice, that's what we're doing, is we're uniting it, all of these aspects.
But most of the time during the day, we cannot pay attention to it, because there's so much noise.
No, it's a completely different context in everyday life. However, the more that you do this, the more that it becomes just integrated into who you are, and you have a different approach then. You know, a retreat like this is called Seshin, which means a gathering of the heart. Shin, heart, gathering of the heart mind. So it's to gather all of us together, to do it together, but also within ourselves. So we do these Seshins to experience that gathering, and then something rubs off, something comes along with us, because it's you, it's who you are, it's not someone else who experiences this. And so it's a long process, absolutely. And you experience your life differently now than you did 10 years ago, I'm sure.
Sure.
Guillaume, the cook went off. Is it almost time?
It's quarter past one.
Okay. You know, yeah, we talk, so talking about this body mind being united, the jargon word that is always talked about is samadhi. We say that when we sit, we enter a state of samadhi. Right? And it's just that I don't really use these terms and things like that. But there is that experience. What it's talking about is an experience of experiencing something that is not the normal activity of the thought and heart and mind and all of that. Something that's not that usual activity. And it feels so peaceful. And there's a clarity in it. And if we really sit, I don't know about you, but I mean, even just having sat last night and this morning, I feel different. My experience of the moment is different than it was yesterday afternoon at this time. And that is cumulative. So then when you do it, if you sit here for 3 days, we will experience it. We go back into life and then we lose. It's not that we lose it all, but it's just that we return to this normal thing of, and we get caught up in this normal way of being. But it's not lost in the sense that we think it is. We don't have to hang on to it. This is our mistake. We're actually experiencing that because we're not hanging on. We're not entering into the coming and going of thoughts and hanging on to them. And that's why we're experiencing this different way of being. Any other comments or questions? Or?
Well, I was thinking it's a way of caring for our lives. So it comes back to the whole shabbat.
Absolutely.
Whether it's whatever practice we engage in, but that has this energy or something of caring for yourself and for the others, I mean, in this case, but everything really.
Yeah. It is absolutely. Those few little words, tread the path with care. Things fall apart, tread the path with care. That's just phenomenal what is said. It's an amazing economy of language. Wow. Because it is that. Ultimately, that's what it is. And there's this kind of poignancy to it, and this tenderness that's involved, and this kindness, this what we call loving kindness, and basic goodness and all these terms that we hear are all manifest when we tread the path with care. You know, we therefore respect the environment. You know, actually, if we look at our world today, we see how not to tread the path with care, which is manifest. The meanness and the aggressiveness and the lack of attention to the environment and mistreatment of animals and of each other and ourselves, you know, overeating or over drinking or not eating, you know, that's a big one in our culture today. Not eating, cosmetic surgery, not appreciating who we are, the way we are.
Not wanting to show up.
Exactly.
To life, like you say so many times.
Yeah.
Was down a lot to not wanting to be here.
Right. And often that's out of fear.
Yeah.
We don't want to be here because we're afraid of being here.
And a lot of it has to do with judgment, I think. We live in such a judgmental environment.
Yeah.
That it's always compared to others, you always compare to others, which makes it difficult, you know, instead of just appreciating where you are and who you are.
Exactly, and your voice, and your path, and where you walk, and and therefore then appreciating other people's path and voice.
And even because judgment, of course, it has a strong emotional or mixed with thought, but any judgment, my self-judgment or someone that judges me, it's just a thought that appeared, disappeared.
Yeah.
It's nothing. Who cares?
Yeah.
But we care so much.
Yeah.
We care. We're so afraid and addicted to judgment. So.
Yeah. And attached to then how we judge ourselves and how we judge the other, and then it becomes firm. And then we have to impose ourselves. And
by experience, we see that judgment is totally empty. The same person that, or our parents or whoever, the person that we give importance, that is saying, you, the 2 weeks later, we speak and the same person, no, I have a different opinion. So why did I get all fired up about that judgment? That judgment was so empty. And it is based on my judgment of myself. After all these years, judgment still plays a very important part.
Absolutely.
Because it's so enmeshed in culture also. Culture.
Yeah, and then because we are so involved in it, then we have what results is Donald Trump. You know, because it's obvious. It's the obvious result of a culture like that. Or, you know, the example we were talking about last night with the flyer, where you said, oh yeah, with the one for Geneva, it was just you did something, I made a few comments on it, and you did it, and it was fun. Whereas the one here in Paris, it's like, oh, we've been working on this thing since I don't know when, you know, like November? No, I think since February, maybe, right? And because there's so many people involved, there's so many different judgments and so many different opinions, and valuable. I mean, that's why I consult everyone, because I don't want to just make some. I want to hear what people think at the same time. Yeah. And to have different, because of course I can have blind spots, like everybody. So I want to hear what other people have to say.
Because you give importance and we give importance, but we want to collect as many ingredients as possible. That's of course the temptation of any cook.
Exactly.
as many ingredients as possible.
And then at some point you just have to say, okay, well, I'm going to use these, and I'm not going to use that. Exactly. That's true. So, tread the path with care. Things fall apart. Okay.
Yeah, almost 25 past.
Okay. So let's end there and I guess make the circle for the Oreo key, and then if you need to go to the toilet or something, and we'll see if they're ready.